Welcome to Stoma and Continence Conversations from Coloplast Professional. I'm Karen.
And I'm Paul. We know that stoma and bowel and bladder issues impact the lives of those that you care for.
We're here to support your educational needs and help you in supporting your patients.
We're talking to fellow healthcare professionals and experts by experience to discuss the latest hot topics in the world of stoma, continence care and specialist practice.
In previous episodes, we've discussed some of the emotions that people can experience in relation to learning intermittent self-catheterisation. Today, we're going to explore this subject in more depth. I'm joined by Dr. Sula Windgassen. Sula is a health psychologist specialising in treatment for those with long-term health conditions. Hello, Sula. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So could we start by, I'm just wondering, what is your role and how do you work with people with long-term health conditions?
So I guess previously I was working as the lead on the long-term conditions pathway in an NHS service. So what that involved was trying to coordinate care pathways for people with long-term health conditions between their physical health service and their mental health service to try and create some integration. And part of that role was having a caseload of people with long-term health conditions and providing cognitive behavioural therapy to them. And my approach has always been very integrative. So I came to health psychology doing mindfulness and compassion focused training. So I've always integrated that in my practice. Since leaving the NHS very recently, I carry on doing exactly that, really providing more integrative therapy. So using cognitive behavioral therapy, compassion focused therapy, mindfulness, and most recently, what's called eye movement desensitization reprogramming, which sounds very, very fancy, EMDR for short, which is kind of, I guess, like a more of a body-based psychotherapy approach, predominantly used for trauma. But I find that it works very well for people with health conditions also to process different things to do with their health and difficult things associated with that.
That's really interesting because I think as a nurse, you so often want to give holistic care and consider the physical and the mental side of things, but often we just don't get that opportunity, or we worry we don't have the skills. So it's fantastic that there's people like you out there who really do focus on that integration between physical and mental health.
Yeah, I mean, on that note, I think what you raise is an important point, which is the willingness of the healthcare professionals. And from my experience, nurses are always the first to embrace holistic care, and they're very much aware of the impact of just the dialogue between them and their patients, which has a huge impact going forwards, even just in setting expectations for treatment and making someone feel safe and cared for. That has a huge impact on treatment trajectories. And there's so much research in health psychology showing the impact of doctor-patient communications, and when the two are aligned in terms of how they felt that consultation went, that's associated with better outcomes. So I know there's lots of concerns about healthcare professionals feeling like they might not have the sufficient skill and they're not psychotherapists, but often it's really basic things and in just hearing what the patient's saying and meeting those concerns that have a huge impact.
Yeah, and I suppose from that perspective, and where you talk about the impact on outcomes, there's probably lots of things going on that many of us just don't appreciate the impact it has on physical health as well.
Yeah, it's such a, the way that I approach health, I suppose, is from a biopsychosocial perspective. So it's understanding that there is that physiological, biological basis and mechanism, but that does interact with our psychological experience of symptoms, of the impact of symptoms, and then that social environmental factor that is also really important, whether that's just from the basics of access to healthcare so that you can rectify or get answers to what you're going through, or your social circle and how accepting they are of any disabilities or impact of symptoms. All of these things really do interact with each other to have an impact on that physical experience that people have. More stressful social environments, more stressful psychological appraisals of what's going on is going to then feed back into that physiology and then have an impact on pain, for example, or ability to heal and the immune system.
Yeah. So looking at ISC in particular, we know that many people are scared of starting ISC. Why do you think that is? Where does that fear come from?
I think it's an intuitive fear, right? Because if we're presented with the idea that we suddenly have to insert something into a body area that we probably don't have that much contact with. And, you know, for many people, I think we were talking at one of those events about, you know, a lot of women not knowing that there are two holes. You know, there's the urethra and then there's the hole that is there for childbirth and reproduction, all the rest of it. So if you're suddenly presented with, oh, there is this small hole that you pee out of and you need to now put something up there, just on a very visceral level, you know, when I first heard about catheterizing, my automatic reaction was just to kind of squeeze my leg shut because it just sounded automatically really painful that you would do that. And same obviously for men, it's counterintuitive to anything that you would do with that body area. So I think there's just a very visceral assumption when you think about it. And that comes with the expectation that it's going to be painful. And you automatically, I guess, predict that you're not going to be able to withstand it. And we know that that power of expectation is huge, you know, even just thinking about the placebo effect and how that can, you know, quite literally impact pain. It can take it away, or with the nocebo effect, it can increase pain and other outcomes if we think that something's going to happen. So it stands to reason, just intuitively, that people be worried about that. And I think that just indicates the importance of being adequately talked through the process, guided through, and provided with some hope that actually, yes, whilst there will be discomfort, you can essentially train yourself so that it doesn't come with the same accompanying stress and worry every time you do it, and that could be desensitized down the line.
Mm. And I think from a very practical point of view, as healthcare professionals, we know that catheterization is a skill that people can learn. And sometimes it feels that initial fear is a bigger challenge than the actual learning of the technique itself. It is overcoming that first step is the hardest bit sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I guess when we're fearful, there can be so many different reactions to that. It can be an automatic shutdown. No, I'll never be able to do it. And that's, you know, our brain trying to protect us. Or it can be, okay, I'm going to do it, but I'm going to, you know, brace myself. And then that increases bodily tension, which might increase pain. And there can be avoidance so that you try it, but then you quickly withdraw. And then you feel like you failed and you can't do it. So this all adds to that experience, whereas if we're provided with some techniques to bring that top level stress down, that can really help, you know, with that fear and help people to approach doing it.
So if we're from a very practical point of view, say we're in a clinic situation and we've got to teach someone ISC and we know they are very scared, how can we as professionals support a patient's psychological well-being in that situation?
The first step is just listening to the patient in terms of what's causing the fear. And some people will be very clear on that. You know, it's going to hurt me loads and I don't think I'll be able to do it. I might cause more problems down there. And some people will just have more of a visceral emotional response. I just don't want to do it. I'm just too scared. So I think first understanding where they are, if they're very clear on that, you can address them where they're at. Okay, I hear this concern. Give them some information that matches that and kind of reassure them on that basis. But if they're at the level where they're just not even able to cognitively engage with what the specific fears are, helping them get there is an important first step. So I think just asking them, you know, often people are worried about this. Is that what you're worried about? And people might say yes, they might say no. And then coming up with some common fears that you're aware that people have about that helps them to make it a bit more specific. And then you can, again, you know, address that specific concern or specific set of concerns, which is really helpful because they inherent in that process, the patient feels heard, they feel like also normalized and validated. Other people have felt like this and gotten through it, which increases their sense of safety. So there's a couple of meta processes just in assessing what specifically it is they're worried about and giving them some details about how that actually might look in reality. And then it might seem, again, out of skill set, like you were mentioning before, but it's a very basic intervention that we know can bring down anxiety and fear response in the moment, which is just helping them breathe. So using diaphragmatic breathing. And often when you explain to people, actually, you know, your brain is on high alert mode and your central nervous system is, you know, ramped up because it feels like it's in complete threat. And that's only going to make it more difficult for you to engage in this information and to learn the techniques and to feel like you can do it. So let's just target that to begin with. And a really simple thing that we can do to activate our soothing arm of the nervous system is to take some nice deep diaphragmatic breaths. So in through the nose, as you breathe in, your stomach expands out. As you breathe out, your stomach goes back in, and just doing some cycles of that until you kind of get them down a couple of points on that anxiety experience scale, just a subjective scale. You know, if you're at a 9, have you come down to an 8 or a 7? And when they're at that space, seeing if they can engage in that discussion again and empowering them to use that themselves, I think can be a really, really helpful tool. Also getting into the body when they're in that moment. So if they're suddenly all tense and they're like, I can't do it, and they've got their legs squeezed together and they're just, you know, jaw clenched, maybe some progressive muscle relaxation to help them release that tension themselves. Again, it communicates to them they do have some agency. They are able to communicate with their body, and it shifts their affective experience, which then might give them more confidence to be able to catheterize.
And I was interested what you were saying about normalizing it as well, because I think anything bladder and bowel, people just don't discuss it, and I think people feel very alone. So is simply explaining that this is something that many people do successfully and without any problem, just that in itself really help that situation.
Yeah, massively. You know, in the research, there's been quite a lot of qualitative research on catheterization, and a recurrent theme across all of the papers that I've read have been feeling like they're the only person in the world to go through this, and feeling a sense of failure or a sense of, yeah, just real distress that they have to now interfere with a bodily process that they feel like everyone else can just get on with. And that is really upsetting. So it's a real powerful intervention, like you say, just to recalibrate that appraisal and say, you know, I see X amount of people who have to catheterize. You're not on your own. Although it feels like it, other people have been where you are right now and have, you know, increased their confidence, feel less stressed about it, are able to do it successfully. And actually, these are the benefits it's afforded them. So I think that clinical anecdote can really, really be powerful because people suddenly feel they're not alone and they are connected. However, having said that, an important caveat, I think, is the tone in which you do it and the words that you use, because sometimes people feel massively dismissed, like, other people do it.
Everyone's at it. Come on. Yeah. Yeah. And I think along those lines, as nurses, we're kind of trying to think of the right word. We're kind of immune to it. We're a bit blasé about these things because it is every day to us. And sometimes I feel we have to stop and really realize the massive impact that it is for that individual person. You know, it's not an everyday occurrence to them, even though it is to us.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be so hard to remember and realize that as healthcare professionals when you are seeing similar things. I think just having that reminder each day that, you know, each person here might be going through this for the first time, and so they feel very differently about this experience to how I do, can have a big shift in how you approach things.
If we don't address the psychological impact of these, what are the long-term implications for individuals doing ISC?
I mean, it will vary. Some people, you know, it won't have much of an impact. You know, we can see some people are just very pragmatic and they see it as a challenge and they, you know, they don't need much intervention. For other people, they can feel really hopeless and helpless and that might have a negative impact on their mood. And we know when people are more distressed, they tend to withdraw more. They, you know, self-neglect just with things like eating, hygiene. It's going to have an impact on catheterization because that's the last thing that they want to do. So that can then lead to, say, infections, then, you know, further complications with health conditions. So it really can have, you know, a cumulative impact if people feel like they're unable to catheterize, essentially. And also we see with people with high anxiety or really low moods or a mixture of both, that also has an impact on how people experience symptoms like pain, but also, say, bladder urgency and that sense of needing to go. Just on that basic, you know, central nervous system activation, when we're stressed, it's more likely to kick our bladder into gear, right? We're more frequently the toilet. And, you know, anybody will have their own anecdote of like when they've got a big thing coming up and then they find themselves going to the toilet maybe a couple of times beforehand. So people might experience an increase in symptoms that they attribute to illness, but actually it might be this interaction of feeling very anxious or feeling very low. And when people are depressed, when people do have high anxiety, this is activation in the areas of the brain that overlap with areas in the brain that process pain. So people might be reporting more pain, things like that. You know, it's useful to understand that they have a knock-on effect on the physiological experience. So it is really important to try and help people feel empowered and heard in those consultations.
I think from my point of view, we simply focus on, you know, people just stop catheterizing. And I think we don't really take into account those things like pain, anxiety, those wider symptoms. So I think that's a really important point you raise. Do you have any top tips for anyone listening who would like to incorporate this into their assessment and care?
Yeah, I would keep it really simple. First of all, in your assessment of the patient that you've got in front of you, I would ask them how they're feeling towards catheterizing, just to get an idea of where they're at. Yeah, I'm fine about it, or this is just something that I have to do. Or, you know, they might then tell you, actually, I'm very nervous, I don't know how I'm going to do this. And then you can, you know, use all of your knowledge and skills to try and reassure and address. Looking out for those people that find it hard to articulate what they're specifically worried about. So trying to help them with that and bringing in that normalizing aspect. So other people have worried about this before. Don't worry, you know, you don't keep worrying about this, but it's very normal to have it where you are. This is what we're going to do to help you with that. It's a process, you know, all of those normalizing things. And then being on the lookout for those patients that are really anxious and maybe asking them a couple of follow-up questions. You know, how does your body generally feel right now? Are you feeling tension? You know, where do you feel your breath? Is it in your chest, or are you taking nice deep breaths? And people, you know, often when people say, oh, I don't really know, it's a sign that they're doing, you know, really anxious shallow breathing. So just introducing diaphragmatic breathing with a bit of psychoeducation that this is a really important tool that you can use anytime to just bring down the top level of, you know, stress or anxiety. And you might feel that it kind of shifts just in this moment, just doing a couple of rounds. Your body might feel slightly more relaxed. You know, I'm not saying you'll feel the most relaxed you've ever felt because you're about to learn how to catheterize or you're about to catheterize, but it might take you down from a 10 to, you know, a 9 or an 8, and we can work with that. So I guess I would keep it really simple, but just at the core, the reminder is, if you're asking your patient how they feel and what they think about something, you're already doing a really important intervention. You're making them feel safe. You're making them feel heard. And we know that that has a big impact on how able people feel to adhere to their medication or adhere to the particular medical procedures that they're being advised to do. So that in itself is key.
And I think it's nice that you emphasise keep it really simple, because I think so many people worry about the time that they've got available to them. You know, clinic slots are precious, and it's sometimes there's a worry about including something else. But if you keep it simple, it can have a huge impact. And I think taking that time early on can help further down the road that your patient remains concordant with their routine, you know, sticks with the treatment plan that you've recommended to them.
Absolutely. And that fear around clinic time and it opening up like a Pandora's box and then the patient's telling you everything. You might get a bit of an inkling if you've got a talker versus somebody that's not a talker. So you might make modifications on that. But generally speaking, what the research seems to suggest is by asking people how they're feeling in a consultation, it doesn't tend to add time to the consultation. And if it does, it seems to be like a maximum of 2 to 4 minutes. So it doesn't add a substantial amount of time, but it does have a big impact then on probably, you know, how that patient's going to present again, if they're going to, you know, be constantly seeking further healthcare appointments and, you know, very worried or not.
With ISC, we also see people who have long-term conditions such as MS, and we know that they view ISC as a particularly negative thing because it can be a sign that their long-term condition is deteriorating, particularly ISC. They see that as it's the next step towards my MS getting worse. Do you approach that patient group in a different way, or do these techniques apply to all kinds of issues that people may have?
Yes, to answer your question briefly, I think it applies to everybody, because even in asking them how they're feeling about ISC, you might then get a very honest response of, well, this is a sign that I'm only getting worse. And you can either, you know, help them reframe that. This is going to give you more independence, you know, whatever else, you know, you might bring in there. Or, you know, you can, for some people, it might just be about hearing that and saying, I understand the heaviness of this procedure for you. Maybe just those words are enough. I understand. You don't have to fix. You don't have to change. You've acknowledged it, and then you're going to go into whatever you're going to go into with your consultation anyway. But them having felt heard, even though, and I get this as a psychotherapist and psychologist, you know, even though you don't get that, oh, thank you for that. That was really helpful. I feel much better. It hasn't gone unimpacted, if that makes sense. You know, it still has a positive impact, and it makes people more likely to engage in the next step than if you weren't to do that. So yeah, I think it does just come back to assessing how the person's feeling about this right now, what it means to them, how they're doing generally. Then you can kind of tailor how you're relating to them, rather than let's just get this done, it's just another thing. You can perhaps be a bit more patient or a bit more checking in with them, more warm, reassuring, all of those kind of things.
Yeah, I suppose it's tailoring it to that individual's response and how things are going for them, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Stoma and Continence Conversations is brought to you by Coloplast Professional. To learn more, visit coloplastprofessional.co.uk.